Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Monday morning. I'm back now from Florida. I was there at Scholar in Residence over the weekend. Thanks to Shimon to our garden for sponsoring that at Williams Island. I want to mention Rabbi and Mrs. Horowitz, who are very gracious hosts. They really were very nice to us, to my wife and myself. Today's podcast is being sponsored, as I mentioned last week, by the Rechtans. This tomorrow, I guess, yeah, Adar 2, 2 days in Adar. Tomorrow is the yahrzeit of Estelle Rechtan's father, Yaakov Rachmiel ben Moshe Tzvi, who was from Lodz. And as I mentioned again, you know, that's one of the worst. I don't know if there were good places to be in the Second World War, but the Lodz ghetto was among the worst. And apparently he was a goldsmith in Poland and all the rest of it. Well, look, he went through the camps, you know, what's there to talk about? And lost the whole family. I mean, we know the story. As I said, the Polish were there for 6 years. It's terrible, from 39 to 45. Whether the Germans used this type of concentration camp or that kind of killing or that kind, you know, they had all kind of sadistic things in Poland. So it was really rough. And I guess after the war, she said ended up in Belgium and then came to this country and was in Baltimore. It was in Baltimore. I did not know him. I must have davened in my shul before I was there because they're all the survivors, you know. Anyway, but she says he was a very sweet storyteller and loved to tell jokes. I'm sorry, I didn't know. Anyway, so we pay tribute to his memory, as with everybody else in the Shoah. As you see, he does survive through his family, his children, his grandchildren, and the others. That's the only positive spin you can put on people who went through that kind of a hell. So thank you. We're looking at Parshas Pekudei, in which we conclude, obviously, the stuff with the Mishkan. The history of the Mishkan, it's interesting. I mean, there are no coincidences, I guess. And I happen to be, you know, before Purim every year, always doing more Megillah, for a reason. And we have seen him on Purim and so forth and so on. And so I was just looking at... Notice I have a funny way of doing it. I do the last parak, then the third parak, then the second parak, and then I do the first. So now I'm in the first. And it happened to be in the Mishnah, just now, where it says, Ein bim bama gadola, bama katana, ella pesachan. Where it talks about bama gadola and bama katana. Bama gadola, bama katana. Now, you know what a bama is, a high place. No, it's a private place of offering karbonas. On the other hand, the Mishkan, this place you're supposed to offer karbonos, right or wrong, is very confusing. If you look throughout the Chumash and the Tanakh, you find this funny confluence that sometimes there was a Mishkan or a Beis HaMikdash in which the cult was centralized. You were not allowed to offer sacrifice anywhere else. And then other times you see not that way. And it's not simple as to the chronology. Again, you look through the Tanakh, they'll say these guys offered karbonos at this bama. Just off the top of my head, remember Shimshon and his parents, when they were told by the angel they offer a karbon up there. Gideon, I remember, offers up a karbon. Not in a Mishkan, in a backyard. Many of us have been to Israel. If depending on where you go, they'll show you places still left over from the high places, the bamas. The Mishkan seems to be the opposite. The Mishkan is... this is where you're supposed to bring the karbonos, and not somewhere else. As I told you before, the Rambam, if you want to be rational about it, tries to portray the Mishkan as a kind of effort to do away with the bamos, because when you leave religion into private hands, especially in those eras when people are into idolatry, they'll become syncretistic and they'll mix together Jewish ceremonies with pagan ceremonies. Who knows what they'll do? But on the other hand, if you say you can bring carbonos, but they're all done at one central location and it's under control of the Kohanim, they will do it exactly the right way. In other words, you don't offer the carbon, you bring the carbon. They do the actual execution of the sacrificial ritual. And they'll be sure to do it in a way that has no paganism in it. You know, so it's a certain way of, like I said before, if you got to do drugs, you know, go to a clinic, you know, that sort of thing. Where they'll do it in a supervised way. That's the famous Maimonidean approach. Having nothing to do, by the way, with the question whether carbonos are time-bound or not. In general, you want a carbon done right, you get a professional. Get it? You can fix your own car. Most people take it to a professional, you know. You can do a carbon, but you want to take it to somebody who knows exactly what to do. Has the right kavanas, does it in the right place, you know, following the rituals that God laid out in Shemos and Vayikra and Bamidbar and Dvarim. That's the basic idea. But as I say again, it's hard to trace through the exact history of the Mishkan and the Bamos and this and that and the other. And I was looking, and there are times when the Mishkan is called a Bama or a Bama Gadola, as they call it over here. That's why it's a famous Mishnah that says in Megillah, first parak, Ein bein Bama Gadola, Bama Katana El Pesachim, that the difference between the Bama Gadola and the Bama Katana was Karbonos like Pesachim, you know, time-bound ritual sacrifices and things like that. Now, I think many people are familiar with that Mishnah, that Gemara. So, if you, the Chazal struggled to construct a narrative to get it right, when was there a Mishkan? When were there Bamos? Was there any different forms of Mishkan? Eventually the temple was erected. How exactly does the history go? Because the truth is, we don't know that much about what happened to the Jews after the Chumash. We don't even know that much in the Chumash. But, you know, we know Joshua fought these wars to conquer Israel. Yeah, but it's very undetailed. And we know that there was a Mishkan, like you see in the book of Shmuel, you know, when the Chana goes to the Mishkan. You know, the Mishkan, the Philistines captured the Ark. We know that story. It doesn't say they destroyed the Mishkan, although the Chazal say that. And you see David HaMelech has a funny situation where he has a tent in Jerusalem in which the Aron is in. But that's not the place they do the Karbonos. When you wouldn't do Karbonos, Shlomo goes to Givon. Is it confusing? So the way you put it together in the rabbinical literature, especially in the Masechta Zevachim, 14th chapter and 13th chapter in the Tosefta and all the rest of it, is in a certain way. The art scroll, not the dumbbell Mishnah, the regular, whatever they call it, you know, with the dark cover. They put it together in an English paragraph. Okay, listen to this. If you want to get the party line on how we understand the narrative of when you're allowed to bring a private carbons and when you're not, so it came and went. As he says over here, I'm quoting. Originally, one who desired to sacrifice to God did it wherever he wanted. That's why Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and all that did it in their own place. No specific place, and so on and so forth. That's called a boma. Right? In other words, you put together a little mound, and on it, you offer the carbon. After the Jews left Egypt, they were commanded to put up a Mishkan. That is our Parsha today. Ele b'kudi ha-mishkan mishkan ha-edus. This Mishkan, tabernacle, would be the dwelling of the of the Shekhinah, and it would be the only altar used for offering sacrifices. So when the Bnei Yisrael had a full running Mishkan, as we'll see in a second what that means, so then there's Isra Abomas. No, that's another way of saying you have to bring any carbon you want to bring, you have to do it in the Mishkan, nowhere else. And the Torah strictly prohibited the use of Abomas in the 40 years in the desert. So if you remember, in Achrimos, which is coming a little bit later, it says in Perek Yud Zayin, Ish Ish Mbeis Yisrael, Asher Yishchat Shoro Kesev Eiz B'machne, or Asher Yishu Mechutz Machane, anyone who wants to offer up some kind of a carbon, V'al Pesach Lo Omoid Lo Heviyo, if he doesn't bring it to the Pesach Omoid, to the door of the Omoid. Now, if you don't do it through the Mishkan, Dom Yechashim Dom HaShabach Nichol Yisrael Kem Yechayim Karis. You said blood, yeah? No, it's like you're killing somebody. That's a strong lashon. Lamana Asher Yavi B'nei Yisrael Zibchehem Hashem Simcha Pnei Asadeh, so that the Jewish people who are accustomed to offering their korbanos all over the place, al Pnei Asadeh, Heviyim LaHashem a Pesach Omoid al Kohen, right? They should, you know, bring it to the Kohen. And it says over there specifically, because there were, because when you do it on your own, too many people mixed up paganism syncretistically together with Judaism. They're bringing a korban to Hashem, but guess what? So that they won't offer up their korbanos to these shadim, these demons. Rashi says seirim is shadim. Look it up in Achrimos. So in other words, they're getting it wrong. I see the Rashbam says la seirim below la shamayim. I think others say it was for both. It's very easy to not to get your rituals impure, shall we say. Not doing it entirely in a monotheistic way. And the Torah, of course, wants you to do it in a monotheistic way. Okay, so for the 40 years in the desert, there was yes Mishkan and no Bamas. After Moshe died, the Jewish people crossed the Jordan. They set up a Mishkan in Gilgal. I think you know that from the book of Joshua. And the Mishkan remained in Gilgal for 14 years during the time of what we call Shibasha. The era of Joshua, when they conquered the land of Canaan, or they conquered whatever part of it that they conquered, they didn't do all of it, and they divided them among the tribes. So during those years, you had a Mishkan in Gilgal, the same Mishkan, you know, was taken down and set up there. And during that time, Heter Abamos, you were allowed to use the Abamos. So that's interesting. The Jewish people were brand new into Israel. The truth of the matter is a little strange to me, because now they encountered the Canaanites, and it says several times in the Chumash, you're going to come and take over their farms and their lands, Batim Tov Mashalo Bonisa, Krum Mashalo Natata, Zazim Shalno Natata. You're taking over whole areas of agriculture and houses and things like this, and you didn't build them yourselves. And make sure, Mizbechosam Titotsu Hashem Techeresa, remember that? In other words, don't use their pagan stuff. You can use their living room, you can use their dining room, you can use the front lawn, and even their cows and stuff, but not the idols that you should destroy. Okay, I get that. So it's a little strange that they would allow you to offer up bomos in the local areas, because the truth of the matter is, the Jewish soldiers encountering all this paganism, I mean literally paganism, probably be tempted. Why should I go? Let's say I was a soldier at that time, just for pretend. And I'm in a place, the tribe of Ephraim or Manasseh, whatever. And we have the wars. And then I get my spoils of war. So they give me this farm. They say, Katz, this is your, you know, karka. So and so many acres and so much. And the enemy has either been killed out or driven out or something. So it's all empty. And I walk in as a going concern. And, you know, you got to start plowing the field, picking the cherries, picking the apples, taking care of the animals, whatever they are, the big animals, the little ones, the chickens, the chasmas. You know, farming is a full-time business. And as I look around, I could see, oh, the family, the Canaanite family left behind, I don't know, utensils, cutlery, clothes, I don't know, verves. I mean, there was stuff, right? Among the things that I find living around the house and on the estate are idols. Could be made out of gold or silver. Those I'm not allowed to use. Could be, there's a very nice little chapel or Bama or something like that, in which the former owners used to offer up korbanos in a nice, cozy little scene. It's very tempting, I would think, for me to say, okay, now I'll convert it for Jewish purposes. As you call it in America, you sell a church and buy a synagogue. Which the truth of the matter is that was very controversial back in the 1800s, but it's done. And used to be Geish and now it's Jewish. What's your problem? But it's a problem. Right? Because Asherim Tichrosim, Titotsim, you got to get rid of all that stuff. So I would think, Dafka, during the 14 years, when they're conquering and apportioning the land, they would not be allowed to do the bummus. They would tell everybody, don't offer up any carbon, period, unless you go to the Mishkan. But that's not the case. On the other hand, once they mamash settled down, okay, the Mishkan of Gilgal did not have the stat. I'm reading again. Did not have the status of the Mishkan of the wilderness, but of a Bama Gedola. Okay? Now, what does that mean, a Bama Gedola? So get used to these two terms. Three terms. Actually, four. Number one, Mishkan. Number two, Bama Gedola. Number three, Bama Katana. Number four, Beis HaMikdash. You'll find this in the rabbinic literature, Talmudic literature. Again, it's Bama Gedola, Bama Katana, is a Mishkan. Is a Beis HaMikdash. Okay? Now, what's the definition of Bama Gedola? I'll get into that in a second. Private altars, Bamas Katanas, were permitted during this period of the Mishkan being in Gilgal 14 years. After the land was divided among the tribes and the people settled in their territories, they erected a Mishkan in Shiloh. Okay? That's a full-blown Mishkan. So you had the regular Mishkan in the desert. You had the Mishkan, Bama Gedola, for the first 14 years after they crossed the Jordan. And then you had, once again, a restoration of the full-blown Mishkan, okay, in Shiloh. That's why you go, tourists go to Shiloh and all that. The Torah calls this Menucha, okay? Listen closely. During the 370-year period of Shiloh, Bamas were again forbidden. So 369 years to be exact. So for almost 370 years, that's a long time where I come from, Yutaka had the situation I just described before. We don't trust you to offer up carbonus in your local bummus. You got to offer up carbonus in the Mishkan. That's why Shmuel and his family, who were from Jews, what do you call it? They used to, They used to offer up carbonus in the Mishkan. Again, I repeat, you do find Gideon, I remember, who else? The parents of Shimshon, others in the book of Shoftim here and there, who do offer up carbonus, I think. Even though technically speaking, they should have done in the Mishkan. Gideon just offered up in his, he wasn't even so from his family, had idols. So there's a difference between what you're supposed to do and what people did. I think we all know that nowadays also. But technically speaking, formally, for the period of what you and I call the period of the Shoftim, except it was first 14 years, so you're not allowed to offer Bamas Katanos. And then we know, sort of by the book of Shmuel, mainly by rabbinic tradition, that the Philistines captured the Ark in the Battle of Aphek. That's, time of Shmuel, Eli, Chavni Pinchas. That's in the book of Shmuel. And then they destroyed Shiloh. That's in the Gemara. Okay, so there was no more Mishkan. It was physically destroyed. Whatever was left, they burned the building or something like that. But you still had, let's say, for example, the Mizbeach, Mizbech HaNechoshes. The Mishkan was then transferred to Nov. How do you know that? Because there's a story of King David and Saul and Saul's massacre to Kohanim of Nov. I mean, that's where they had, that's where they had the Mizbeach and everything. So the Mishkan was transferred to Nov. After Saul killed out the Kohanim of Nov, the Mishkan was transferred to Givon. Okay? So how long was this period between the Philistine destruction of the Mishkan and this location of whatever was left, first in the city of Nob, then the city of Gibeon. The answer is 57 years. So during that time, when there was no Mishkan in the regular way, it was Bama Gdola. So what was there? You could do Heter Abamas. You could do your private Abamas again. And then, of course, came, you know, Shlomo HaMelech in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. And then the Abamas were again prohibited. And they remained prohibited forever. Ad Yom HaZeh. So, it's a funny history. You were not allowed to bring private Karbonas. Then you were allowed to bring private Karbonas for 14 years. Then you were not allowed to bring private Karbonas for 370 years. And then you were allowed to bring private Karbonas for 57 years. And then after that, you're not allowed to bring Karbonas anymore. You see what I'm saying? It's up and down. That's basically the history. Now, what's the definition or the difference between Bama Gedola, Bama Ketana, or more specifically, Mishkan and Bama Gedola? So the Tosefta, the Mashiach Chachma, it so happens, I'm making coincidental. I was looking at the Gemara, and then this week is Pekudei, and I happened to just open the Mashiach Chachma because I had a hunch he would talk about it. And he does because our parsha begins, Eil Pekudei HaMishkan Mishkan HaEdus. This is the counting of the Mishkan, Mishkan HaEdus. Translate the word Mishkan HaEdus, right? Don't tell me the tabernacle of testimony, you know, Mishkan HaEdus. So it means the Mishkan that contained the Ten Commandments, okay? And what's the pshat? The definition of a Mishkan, full-blown Mishkan, is you have two things there at the same time. The Mizbech on the one hand, and the Aron on the other. When you don't got a Mishkan. You got a Bama Gedola. I'm going to read you a short passage in the Mashiach Chachma. If there was an Aron, and it says, and then he starts talking about the Aron, the box, which was covered with gold and silver outside, inside and outside. So, it doesn't have a din of an Aron unless it has the Ten Commandments, the Luchos in it. But Mishkan, Emasu Nechshav Lo Moed Leser Abamos. So when does the Mishkan have the status of a full-blown Mishkan so that private Karbonos are also, you have to do it only Mishkan, Rak Kishi Ish Ba'aron. You see? What makes the Mishkan, in the sense of exclusivity, is the presence there of the Aron, and the Aron can't be there unless it has the Ten Commandments. Right? Kedetan Tosefta So Pesachim, and he quotes up a Tosefta here, pulling out my rusty, trusty Tosefta in back of Pesachim, Steinzel edition, he's got the good Girsa. Eze Bama Gedola, this is the Tosefta now, in Perek Yud Gimel, in Pesachim. Eze Bama Gedola, Mashah Sekhter Abamas, what's a Bama Gedola? Meaning, during the 14 years of Joshua, during the 57 years of the Philistine, in Nob and Gibeon, when is it called a Bama Gedola? And you're allowed to do private Bamas? Ohel Moi Noti Gedarko, Ein Aron Nosen Sham. If you have everything minus the Aron. So the Philistines, of course, captured the Aron. And you will remember the story. It's a little weird. That the Philistines ended up returning the Aron because of the hemorrhoid attack. And they put the Aron up here and they put the Aron up there. King David eventually transferred the Aron to Yerushalayim. But the Aron was not together physically with the Mizbeach and the other pertinences of the Mishkan. That was in Givon, for example. Right? This is kind of interesting. When David runs away from Saul and goes to Nov without telling them that he's running away from Saul. He goes to the, you know the story. He goes to the high priest over there, talks about the lechem upon him, you know, because they ate it, and things like that. He asked for the sword of Goliath. Aron and Ten Commandments are not there. The Aron and Ten Commandments were elsewhere. So it's a funny zach. The two things that together constitute the Mishkan were in two separate places for decades. When King David, as you will possibly remember, had this whole ceremony when he transfers the Aron to Jerusalem, but the Mizbeach wasn't there. Shlomo HaMelech, when he's young and has that dream where he asks for wisdom, and then give him. Not in in Yerushalayim. Why does he do that? He doesn't go to the Aron. He goes to the what do you call it? To the altar and give him. So when you have one without the other, you have the Mizbeach and the other stuff. Minus the Aron, it doesn't have a din of a Mishkan. It's called a Bama Gedola. Eze Bama Ketana B'Shas Hetra Abamas. What's a regular Bama? The Tosefta goes on to say, you can make a little mound in front of your house, in your backyard. The whole family can offer karbonos when anybody wants it. So it's strange. I guess you'd say that you could have heter habamos, that this business of private worship was permitted 57 and 14. So what's that, 67, 74, almost 75 years in the course of Jewish history. Not more than that, right? It's a very small, slot for when you were allowed to do so. And that's why he says over here, Zeshamar din mishkan yeshol keshu mishkan eid shei nothin bo. So Meshach Chacham is metayik when it says, eid b'kuni mishkan mishkan eid is, this is the accounting, for the construction of Mishkan, I'm talking about the full-blown Mishkan, the Mishkan Eidus. Mishkan that has the Aron with the Ten Commandments inside the Aron located within the Mishkan. So you have the Mizbeach together with the other thing. So it's an interesting image that we end up with here. In order to have a Mishkan status, you need two central things together in close proximity. You need the Aron and you need the Mishkan. You need the Aron with the Luchos, and you need the Mizbeach, and the other things also, the Menorah and so forth. So in other words, it's possible to have a Mishkan, but it's strange. It's possible to have a Mishkan minus the Aron, but then it's called Bama Gedol, then it's not a Mishkan. So I can only suppose, I'm just thinking here, that in order to get the full business, that the person who takes his sacrifice to the Mishkan will have the full benefit of the religious experience. It has to be that you, let's say it was myself, for argument's sake, and let's say I was a Yisrael or something, which I'm not, and I bring a carbon to the base of Migdash, to the Mishkan, rather, when it was the base in Shiloh. Oh, I see an altar. I have an altar in my backyard, right? I mean, bamas are easy to put together in your front lawn, your backyard, wherever you want. But I see the Mizbeach is located right near a tent. And I say, what's inside the tent? And you're going to say, well, in the tent is located the actual Luchos, that Moshe had been brought down from Har Sinai. As we discussed last time, might even be the Shiver Luchos of the Luchos Rishonas. You have some heavy artifacts there, baby. I mean, these are things from Hashem Mamish. And that should put you in a state of mind of awe and like, wow, this is amazing. And this is fearful. And I better not mess with the rules. And I better not offer any kind of Avodah Zarah type stuff involved. And my mind should be better concentrated toward Avodah Hashem, as opposed to vote as anything else, like the Seirim that are referred to in the book of Vayikra and other things like that. And then the Mishkan experience is a Mishkan experience. But when the Aron isn't there, as was the case during, like I say, after the Philistines destroyed Shiloh, so let's say I went to Nov, or let's say I went to Givon, even the time of David HaMelech. I come there. I mean, it is impressive. From a Genozim point of view, you want to sell, artifacts. Then I'm looking at the Mizbeach that was constructed by Moshe and Bezalel and Oliv and all that stuff. I mean, that's true, So they would see that, although a lot of the rest of the Mishkan was reconstructed after the Philistines destroyed it. But anyway, you do see the Mizbeach. And I guess you see the Menorah and so forth. I mean, I get that. But the Iker Chosim and HaSefer, you do not see the Aron. I mean, there's a tent.
Well, there was no, maybe there was no tent. Actually, there was no tent. So all you see is the arm. And, you know, let's put it this way. Minus the tent, it's a place for offering sacrifices. It's a Bama Gadola. Notice it has central status. It's the remnants of the Mishkan until they build another Mishkan or base of Mikdash. But it ain't the same thing, you see. In order for it to have the full impact, you have to see the Aron plus the you have to see the Mizbech, I'm sorry, together with the Aron and the other stuff. And indeed, we just saw that, as the Meshech Chachma puts it, if there's no Ten Commandments inside the Aron, then there's no point for an Aron. Which, of course, is why, as you and I know from Yuma and such places, what was in the Second Temple? The answer is, in the Kodesh Kodosh, was an empty room. Now, why? Why didn't they have, you know, a box with, you know, with nothing in it? You know, I mean, they didn't have the luchos. The luchos were buried, gone, whatever. Why don't you have at least an Aron and the Krubim and all the rest of it? Why don't you do that? And yet, as you see from the pictures, if you get the picture of Mishnayos from Yuma, or you can go online, I'm sure it's there, the Kohen sprinkles the blood as if the box was there. But the box is not there. Because you can't have an Aron unless there's a, if it's empty. As he puts it over there, the Aron Mukhrech Lo She'il Edus. The Aron has to have the luchos in it. Right, im ein luchas ein osim arn, right? He's in fact he says kach kosim the what's his name? The Meshech Chachma says elsewhere. I'm looking at the fancy schmancy edition of the Meshech Chachma now, with the nukuda, with the nukudas at the top, and all the notes at the bottom, and he says that elsewhere in chaf hey am chaf aleph, so that would be I guess in Bayakel. He says over there. Call a kelim also, but make the sheni levad ha'aron. Then a bayis sheni, you didn't have an aron. Ki haluchos nignazu, because since the luchos were gone, haluchos makim an aron. And without the luchos, you don't have an aron. Bekim shemig the sheni lohay luchos, lohay bar. So we see that it's not simply a bunch of furniture, although it is that, but it's furniture in a certain relationship. And certain things are ma'akev the others. And you some things have to be there. And some things it doesn't have to be there. And the Mishkan went up and down. We hope, of course, there'll be a bayis shlishi. They'll find all this stuff. Then you have a Mishkan and Aron. Although, by the time you get to bayis sheni, for various reasons, there weren't bummos because the Jewish people had been cured from idolatry. That's the famous story where they got rid of the Yetzirah of Zorah. And the historical conditions were quite different. The problems we had in Bayis Sheni were not problems of idolatry. The problems we had in Bayis Sheni were not problems of a syncretism. The problems in Bayis Sheni were problems of the type we face in the state of Israel today, which is the disunity, the sinas chinam, the fights over this, drafting people, whatever. Those things can transcend, unfortunately, as we know, even a perfect base in Mikdash. Anyway, I went a little bit long, but you understand what I'm saying. It's very interesting when you consider the actual history and chronology of when the stuff was heter abamas, low heter abamas, and what does it require to make a Mishkan a Mishkan. It's not just the outer building. It's got to be the stuff inside. A box, which is empty on the inside, is no good, even if it's the most sacred of the boxes. Anyway, I want to thank the Recht Hands again for sponsoring it. I hope the Father's Neshama, which is the Yard Sage tomorrow, will have an Aliyah. And with that, I wish you a good week.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.